This is Washington Watch with Tony Perkins, powered by the Family Research Council, your embassy of faith, family, and freedom in the heart of our nation's capital. Now, here's your host, FRC President Tony Perkins.
Well, good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to Washington Watch. Coming up on this Tuesday edition, it has been over 50 years since the last significant higher education reform measure passed Congress. Well, members of the House Committee on Education and the Workforce say that the Lyndon B. Johnson's vision for higher education, which has become a vehicle for the liberal agenda on college campuses, no longer serves students well. And as we've reported here, in recent years, many college campuses have virtually shut down free speech of conservatives and Christians. The higher education reform measure making its way through Congress includes religious liberty protections. Congressman Tim Walberg of Michigan will be here to lay out the proposed changes that will better serve students and their families. And a study released last week reveals that millennials who attended evangelical Protestant church schools are more likely to marry and have children. Now, why does that matter? We'll talk about it with educational researcher Dr. Beth Green with Cartus Education. And the Republican National Committee passed a resolution this past weekend siding with President Donald Trump in his effort to deactivate the cultural time bomb the Obama administration set off on their way out the door in our nation's military. FRC's own General Jerry Boykin is here to explain. And finally, while President Trump's tax reform is fueling the economic benefits of a free market economy, liberals in California are still pursuing the failed policies of socialism and redistribution. Ken Blackwell, Senior Fellow for Human Rights and Constitutional Governance at the Family Research Council and former Ohio Secretary of State, joins us on that story. So a lot to cover today in this Tuesday edition. So if you happen to miss anything on your way home, well, you can find it all later at the website, TonyPerkins.com, where all of our programs are archived. Again, that website, TonyPerkins.com, lots of resources and links to other information there on that site. And we just have a very few seats left on our April Israel tour. If you're interested, go to the website, TonyPerkins.com. Again, just a few seats left. Congressman Michelle Bachmann, General Jerry Boykin, Ken Blackwell, Joel Rosenberg, all joining us on that tour coming up April the 17th. So find out more, go to TonyPerkins.com. If you're on Twitter, you can keep up with me, at T Perkins. All right. To call the Higher Education Reauthorization Act of 1965 groundbreaking would only tell part of its story. It did break ground, but the evidence suggests that now many of our nation's students are stuck in the mud. In December, Republicans on the House Committee on Education and the Workforce introduced the Promoting Real Opportunity, Success, and Prosperity Through Education Reform Act, the first real step from Congress in reauthorizing the Higher Education Act of 1965. With us now is Congressman Tim Walberg. He represents the 7th Congressional District of Michigan. He serves on the House Education and Workforce Committee and the chairman of the Subcommittee on Health, Employment, Labor, and Pensions. Congressman, welcome back to Washington Watch.
Tony, it's good to be with you. Thanks for the good work you do.
Well, thank you. And this bill that you're working on, along with Congresswoman Virginia Fox, is groundbreaking in that this addresses a lot of how, in my view, as I've read through the bill, and it's a pretty lengthy bill, 590 pages, the left has hijacked higher education, and this is bringing it back to really the students and their families and what their parents are paying for when they send them off to college.
And the principles of freedom. Tony, I suppose if you and I could talk, we would both agree that the federal government really shouldn't have a place in education. I read my Constitution. I don't see any inferences or spots or articles or sections in our U.S. Constitution that gives the federal government any responsibility for education. That takes place in the states and the local communities. And I don't see the Northwest Ordinance phrase that said religion, morality, knowledge being necessary to good government and the happiness of mankind, schools and the means of education shall forever be encouraged. That's in the Michigan Constitution, and I know several other state constitutions, but not the federal government. But having said all of that, we know that we deal with what's real right now and try to, at the very least, evolve the control of the federal government on education, higher education in this case, as best as possible and keep moving in the right direction. And the PROSPER Act does that, taking aim at what's been going on in the education establishment of controlling the hearts, minds, and understanding of our people and the politics ultimately in our civilization.
Right, because what happens on those college campuses eventually finds its way into the halls of government.
Absolutely, and we're seeing training grounds for a small liberal mindset that comes in, doesn't understand what true education is about, that lifts society, that motivates people to think toward truth, and understanding that truth is non-negotiable, it is or it isn't. And what we've seen today is educationists that are trying to blockade off the free exchange of ideas and control what goes on, not only in the minds of their students, but also institutions, and taking institutions like Hillsdale College in my district or Wheaton College, one of my alma maters, and saying to them, you cannot stand for your distinctives and expect to be accredited. We're going to hold your feet to the fire until you acquiesce to what we want you to speak for.
Well, Congressman Wahlberg, what we saw in the last administration is that the mechanisms of higher ed that are controlled by the federal government were weaponized to try to make, as you pointed out just a moment ago, religious institutions to conform to a liberal mindset. And they do that a couple of ways. One, they do it through student loans, disqualifying them from student loans by erasing or eradicating their accreditation. So what this bill does is that it actually says, look, college campuses should be a bastion of free speech and the free exchange of ideas.
Right.
You're not forcing a conservative viewpoint. What you're saying is all viewpoints should be allowed on a college campus.
All treated equally. Sierra Club, if they have a club on campus, ought to be able to have their own people involved with it, have the basic tenets that require their leadership to espouse Sierra Club philosophy. And then I think those that are related to InterVarsity Christian Fellowship ought to be able to invite anyone and everyone into their meetings, but still have the ability to say there are principles that we expect our leadership to follow. And if you can't, then you can't be a leader. So those are some of the principles we reaffirm in our PROSPER Act, as well as when you're talking about loans, grants, scholarships, et cetera, work-study programs. We're expanding higher education and its use of that to say it's not only for our four-year college and university institutions, but it can be for trade schools, apprenticeship programs, paid internship programs that allow our students to be educated beyond the high school into some type of certification, associate's degree, or bachelor's, graduate degrees that lead toward a solid understanding that promotes a job that they can carry on in society.
What, Congressman, bothers me so much, because I've actually seen it applied to conservatives. In fact, its use has grown in its frequency, and that is these free speech zones to either restrict the speech of students or those coming onto the campus. And as I understand this bill, what it lays out is it says, look, you can establish free speech guidelines. Obviously, we want order on our college campuses. But what they can't do under the provisions of this bill is change the standards, the rules of the game, just because they want to eliminate a speaker or a particular subject.
Right. Absolutely true. Again, we're going to give you all the same opportunity. And if we have a free speech zone for one speaker, it's going to be the same for every other speaker that comes on campus. And you're right, Tony. We want to make sure that we don't have campus speech that causes such foment that we go into riots that we've seen at times, even most recently at Berkeley. But we need to make sure that those Berkeley students or those individuals that are paid in some cases to come on campus and disrupt understand that, no, everyone will be treated equally, and free speech is truly that here, as long as it remains orderly.
Well, Congressman Wahlberg, that brings up a question. This bill treats everyone the same in terms of the free speech equality of speech, if you will. Everybody can say their viewpoint as long as in the confines of the law. Why then is there opposition to that concept? Why is it that liberals do not want free speech and conservatives are fine with free speech, freedom of association, even if it's contrary to their principles and viewpoint?
Right. I think it indicates that liberals aren't liberal with their willingness to extend the same freedoms and opportunities to people who disagree with them as they would to people who agree with them. It's a change agentry that's going on, and we've seen it for too long, and I think that's why we're concerned about higher education. It's become a bastion for change agentry in moving us away from the solid principles that began with the Reformation, were carried out in the documentation that established our great country, all the freedoms with responsibility that we have here, and all of the success that came from it. They still believe that anything other than free enterprise capitalism truly a Christian environment that gave opportunity for all people is something that we have to end and take it to a socialist point of view. That is why we cannot allow our higher education institutions to continue to capture our young minds and reshape them against what makes this country great, as opposed to saying, we want to fill your minds with all sorts of thoughts, freely given and freely considered, and then from that, build upon it your education that makes a difference for you and others in years to come with the freedom and opportunity.
Absolutely, and especially when many of these institutions, well, all of them from the standpoint of student loans, are receiving tax dollars. They should not be fomenting an anti-American platform. Now, I'm not saying that they should be, propaganda for the United States, but they sure shouldn't be working against the principles of our republic and our freedom. You're listening to Washington Watch. I'm your host, Tony Perkins. Glad to have you with us on this Tuesday afternoon. Our guest, Congressman Tim Walberg of Michigan. He represents the 7th Congressional District. We're talking about the Higher Education Reauthorization Act, which is making its way through Congress. It's 590 pages and a pretty significant rewrite or reauthorization of education that hasn't been really changed since the 1960s. One area of great concern that's reflected, I think, in this bill, and I think, Congressman, it's a concern of yours, is how the government has been attacking religious institutions, taking away their uniqueness, and why students and parents want to be in those schools.
Absolutely. I mean, we hear more and more, and there's been lawsuits, especially those schools. And from my reference, one of my alma maters I mentioned was Wheaton. It is a longstanding Christian college, but not specifically related to one denomination. So because of that, they are being pushed back in the past by the federal government, saying you must take on more open stance in areas of the traditional values issues, marriage and the family, and some other things. And because of that, they've had to go to court. We're saying, listen, if it's a longstanding doctrinal position, ministry statement, it ought to be allowed.
And that's the antithesis of freedom to force them to do that. Congressman, we're up against a break. I want to thank you for joining us. We're going to continue to track this bill. Hey, folks, don't go away. We're coming back on the other side of the break. So stick with us. We're not going anywhere. Hope you don't either.
What does sex trafficking, abortion, and pornography have in common? A lot, as it turns out. And all three are on the rise across the world. Today, almost 45.8 million people live in slavery around the world, and around 4.5 million people are slaves in the sex industry. Those who consume pornography are much more likely to seek women for paid sex, many of whom are victims of sex trafficking. Each click of pornography creates demand for more pornography and brings in a profit to the sex industry. The demand causes traffickers, pimps, and those involved in the sex industry to abuse their victims by filming them in sex acts. To learn more about the link between these issues and to find out how you can help stop it, go to frc.org/traffic. Again, that's frc.org/traffic.
Gender reassignment surgery. Once rare and unusual, it is now becoming more and more common. Across the nation, transgender activists are pushing for this costly, extreme, and unproven procedure to be declared medically necessary so that it can be paid for with taxpayer dollars. The problem for these activists is that the evidence is not on their side. In 2016, the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services examined 33 studies on the subject and declared that there was not enough evidence to determine whether gender reassignment surgery improved health outcomes. One study found that those who had undergone gender reassignment surgery showed a suicide rate that was 19 times higher than the general population. Declaring gender reassignment surgery to be medically necessary is not only inaccurate, but dangerous. To view FRC's full report on this important issue, visit frc.org/surgery. Again, that's frc.org/surgery.
Is being right enough to win an election? Many tend to believe that being right, in the sense of being factually correct, is sufficient to win in politics. Unfortunately, political history proves otherwise. The candidate who organizes and communicates the best will beat the opposition, no matter how right the other side is. Christians who are running for public office have a moral obligation to study and learn how to win. They must discover the real nature of politics. Robert Arnakis knows how to win. As senior director for the Leadership Institute, the nation's premier public policy training organization, he has 15 years of grassroots organizing, campaign, fundraising, and communications experience, and has established himself as one of the country's top political trainers. Here, Mr. Arnakis discusses the real nature of politics and how to overcome the odds to win an election. Go to frc.org/speakers to view this timely discussion.
You're listening to Washington Watch. I'm Tony Perkins. Thanks so much for joining us. The website, tonyperkins.com. All right. According to a study released last week, Generation X and millennial-aged adults who attend evangelical Protestant schools are more likely to get married and have children than their peers who attended public schools. Now, research conducted by the Canada-based think tank, CARDIS, also found among young adults aged 24 to 39 that these evangelical Protestant schoolers are less likely to cohabitate. Now, why does all of this matter? Well, we're going to talk about that. Joining us now is Dr. Beth Green, Educational Program Director of CARDIS. Dr. Green, welcome to Washington Watch.
Thank you very much.
I found this very fascinating because it has significant ramifications for public policy and the health of society. But before I venture into that, I want to talk about this particular study. What prompted this research?
So this is part of a very big national survey that we commission in both the U.S. And Canada every 2 years. We commissioned the study because we think that the school sector that you attend matters, not just for learning outcomes, so academic outcomes, but also because it affects the kind of person that you will become when you leave school. So that's your civic engagement, your moral formation, spiritual and religious outcomes. And we're particularly interested in how school interacts with faith formation. So it's very typical to say that school sector doesn't have much of an effect, that religious faith, spirituality, all of that's explained by the faith of your parents, your family, the community you grew up with. And, of course, those things are very important. But we had a hunch that what you learn in school might be relevant too. And our research shows that graduates from graduates from Protestant evangelical schools and independent Catholic schools in the U.S. have very distinct profiles in some of the areas that you mentioned. So in terms of the choices they make about family life, getting married, parenting, having children, but also in terms of their profile as well-rounded, healthy, flourishing citizens.
Now, in this study, this was a sample of about 2,000 private school attendees. The report focused on 245 U.S. students and 203 Canadian students who went to evangelical Protestant schools. Is that correct?
That's correct, yeah. So what we released last week was kind of a smaller dig down deep into the data, because we wanted to examine the pathways that students follow after they graduate high school, because we follow up with them when they're young adults, when they're kind of making those sorts of choices about setting up home, family life, starting work, or maybe going on to further education. So the report that we released examines how those sorts of decisions, like where you go to college and university, the age you are when you get married, the number of children you have, how those choices reinforce and interact with the very clear school sector effect that we're seeing when you attend an evangelical Christian school. And we're seeing that it does really make a difference, and it does matter.
So this is a longitudinal study. You're looking at this long term.
That's right. We follow up with it's not longitudinal in that we're not following the same people every time, but we refresh the sample every 2 years because we're trying to map social changes, and we're seeing that in the general population, fewer people appear to be walking some of these pathways attending Christian schools, making different choices about marriage, cohabitation, and so we're trying to track that, and we have found that if you go to a Protestant evangelical school, you're 60% more likely to be married than a public school graduate. It's making some difference in terms of how people are making choices about their lives and about raising their families.
Now, Dr. Green, you also point out in the study that there is a slight difference between students in the U.S. that go to these evangelical Protestant schools and Canadian students.
That's
who
right.
Go to these. What's the difference?
So I think it's probably to do with how the sectors function in both America and in Canada. So some of the histories around why people started schools and set them up is different. And in Canada, of course, we have got some Christian schools which are actually publicly funded, which is something that doesn't happen in the U.S. I also have a hunch that it may be to do with some of the changes in increasing secularization that we're seeing in Canada. So Canada's in quite a different space to the U.S., although the evidence is that some of these things are happening in the U.S. context too. So that might explain those differences.
Did you look at curriculum that's taught in these schools? Did you
go down that deep? So not in this study. This is a big data set that looks at school sector. So we haven't drilled down into individual schools and patterns of kind of teaching and learning what's actually taught in a school. The good news is that we've got new research that we're commissioning where we will be looking at that. Firstly for Canada, and then we hope to do the same in the U.S. because we're interested in what explains these kinds of differences, you're right, it's going to be about teaching and learning. It's also going to be about the structure of the school, the kinds of people that you interact with, and the relationship between your school and church and home.
It's fascinating stuff. I love it. I want to have you back on talking more about it. We're up against a break. Very quickly, though, and the number of children, do you find a distinct difference in the number of children that these graduates from Protestant schools have?
Yeah, we know that evangelical high school graduates marry younger and have children at an earlier age and often have more. I don't have an average figure for you in front of me, but that is a pattern for the U.S. It's a less marked difference in the Canadian data set.
Well, great. This is, again, fascinating stuff. Dr. Green, thank you for joining us, and we're going to follow back up with you as you get more information from this research.
Thank you.
All right, folks, this is interesting stuff. You can find out more. Go to the website, tonyperkins.com. And, I mean, this proves so much of what we talk about. The social sciences, well done, really, it not that it needs it, but it validates and verifies biblical truth. I mean, if we teach our kids these things, guess what? They live it. I'm going to talk more about this a little bit later here in the program. But coming up next, the RNC passed a resolution this past week supporting President Donald Trump in his efforts to stop the social engineering launched in our nation's military under the Obama administration. General Jerry Boykin is here next. Don't go away. We're back with more after this.
If you had to make a law, where would you start? America's founding fathers determined law from a fixed source, God, but culture has shifted the focus to man's self-determined law. If truth is no longer determined by God, it becomes subjective and open to interpretation. In an incisive new paper, Peter Johnston traces the origins of these dangerous trends in American law and the importance of staying true to our founding principles. To view FRC's new publication, go to frc.org/decay. Is being right enough to win an election? Political history proves otherwise. The candidate who organizes and communicates the best will beat the opposition, no matter how right the other side is. Christians who are running for public office have a moral obligation to study and learn how to win. They must discover the real nature of politics. Robert Ornakis is one of the country's top political trainers. Hear him discuss the real nature of politics and how to overcome the odds to win an election at frc.org/speakers. The Family Research Council had the pleasure of hosting Dr. Michael Paulson to speak about how Christians can respond to arguments against religious liberty. Dr. Paulson argues that religion is different and deems exemptions within the law. A religious person believes in God, and God's sovereignty requires complete devotion, whereas government only requires allegiance and civil duties. The Constitution itself treats religion differently, giving America religious liberty and the freedom to exercise. Visit frc.org/university to hear more about this issue. If you had to make a law, where would you start? America's founding fathers determined law from a fixed source, God, but culture has shifted the focus to man's self-determined law. If truth is no longer determined by God, it becomes subjective and open to interpretation. In an incisive new paper, Peter Johnston traces the origins of these dangerous trends in American law and the importance of staying true to our founding principles. To view FRC's new publication, go to frc.org/decay.
Welcome back to Washington Watch. I'm your host, Tony Perkins. Glad to have you along on this Tuesday afternoon. The website where you can find out more information about the Family Research Council is TonyPerkins.com. Also, all of our programs are archived. If you happen to miss anything, you can find it later at TonyPerkins.com. All right, the Republican National Committee is siding with President Donald Trump on his order to stop what the Obama administration put in place on their way out the door. And that was to force transgenderism on our nation's military. Joining us now is retired Lieutenant General Jerry Boykin. He serves as the Executive Vice President of the Family Research Council. But prior to that, he served 36 and a half years in the United States Army and was one of the original members of the U.S. Army's Delta Force. General, welcome back to Washington Watch.
Thank you, Tony. I'm glad to be with you today.
I should have said my favorite general to Washington Watch.
Well, I appreciate that very much. You're my favorite Marine most of the time.
Okay. All right. We'll get that. Well, I noticed you didn't get into my rank, but that's all right. let's talk about it was interesting. This kind of surprised me that over the weekend when the RNC met in their winter meeting, that they passed a resolution supporting Donald Trump's August demand that the military basically pull the plug on what Obama had put in place on his way out the door, and that was to stop the recruiting of transgendered individuals in our nation's military. How significant is this?
Well, I think it's, first of all, to pass resolutions supporting the president's agenda is, I think, a fairly common thing. But in this case, this is, as you know, this was a bold decision on behalf of the president because he really took on the entire LGBT lobby. So this was a bold decision on his part, but I also applaud the Republicans for standing with him on this because you've got a couple of people within the ranks of the Republican Party that are very prominent people like John McCain and Joni Ernst who have not sided with the president on this issue. So I think it's very important that they put a marker down that they are going to stand with the president as this thing is tested in court.
And not only did they verbalize their support for the president and his policy, but they also urge the Justice Department to aggressively seek the intervention of the U.S. Supreme Court in these lower court decisions that essentially take away the rights of the commander-in-chief to decide how the Army is going to, or the military, I should say, is going to recruit and prepare men and women for its mission of fighting and winning America's wars.
That's right. I'm sitting here with Article 2, Section 2 of the Constitution, and there can be no mistake. It says the president shall be the commander-in-chief of the Army and the Navy of the United States and of the militia of the several states when called into actual service of the United States. Now, there was no Air Force at that time, but the Air Force has been grafted in since it was created in 1947, but it's very clear. He's the commander-in-chief. He determines the composition, the organization, the equipping and training and the deployment and use of our military. That is the job of the president. So fundamental to that is just is the whole idea that the president can determine who serves in the military and for how long they can serve in the military. What we have now is we have three judges in America that have formed a triumvirate, and now we have three unelected judges that have replaced the commander-in-chief with regards to his statutory and constitutional authorities associated with what makes up the military and who can serve in the military. And I think that this is a constitutional crisis, quite frankly, Tony. And everybody's talking about, this memo is a constitutional crisis and all that. No. The constitutional crisis that we ought to be looking at today is the fact that three judges have now usurped the authority that is given to the president in Article 2 of the Constitution.
I mean, General, if you just step back from the issue, and I know this is one issue, as you pointed out, some Republicans don't want to touch it and they're weak-kneed on it because of how vicious the LGBT community is in attacking on this because they don't want the facts out. But let's put another issue in here. I mean, this could be any issue because what you've done here is you've set a precedent in that you allow judges to dictate military policy. So you could put any issue in there.
Well, that's exactly right. And look, the Congress even has the Congress now even has more authority in the military than they've exercised. But the courts don't. The courts don't have the authority to overrule the president on a policy decision that he has made as the commander-in-chief, which is constitutional authority that he's been provided. They don't have that authority. The Congress is a different issue.
Mm-hmm. Well, hopefully the president will be kind of spurred on by this because he knows that there are folks that are standing with him to protect our military from this exploitation with social experimentation. General, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you, Tony.
All right, folks, don't go away. Coming up next, a California mayor wants universal basic income. It's a simple idea, one lump sum from the government, no questions asked. The goal is to reduce poverty. But does it work? FRC's Ken Blackwell will be here when we return. Don't go away. We're back with more after this.
What does sex trafficking, abortion, and pornography have in common? A lot, as it turns out, and all three are on the rise across the world. Today, almost 45.8 million people live in slavery around the world, and around 4.5 million people are slaves in the sex industry. Those who consume pornography are much more likely to seek women for paid sex, many of whom are victims of sex trafficking. Each click of pornography creates demand for more pornography and brings in a profit to the sex industry. The demand causes traffickers, pimps, and those involved in the sex industry to abuse their victims by filming them in sex acts. To learn more about the link between these issues and to find out how you can help stop it, go to frc.org/traffic. Again, That's frc.org/traffic.
Gender reassignment surgery. Once rare and unusual, it is now becoming more and more common. Across the nation, transgender activists are pushing for this costly, extreme, and unproven procedure to be declared medically necessary so that it can be paid for with taxpayer dollars. The problem for these activists is that the evidence is not on their side. In 2016, the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services examined 33 studies on the subject and declared that there was not enough evidence to determine whether gender reassignment surgery improved health outcomes. One study found that those who had undergone gender reassignment surgery showed a suicide rate that was 19 times higher than the general population. Declaring gender reassignment surgery to be medically necessary is not only inaccurate, but dangerous. To view FRC's full report on this important issue, visit frc.org/surgery. Again, that's frc.org/surgery.
If you had to make a law, where would you start? America's founding fathers determined law from a fixed source, God, but culture has shifted the focus to man's self-determined law. If truth is no longer determined by God, it becomes subjective and open to interpretation. In an incisive new paper, Peter Johnston traces the origins of these dangerous trends in American law and the importance of staying true to our founding principles. To view FRC's new publication, go to frc.org/decay. The Family Research Council had the pleasure of hosting Dr. Michael Paulson to speak about how Christians can respond to arguments against religious liberty. Dr. Paulson argues that religion is different and deems exemptions within the law. A religious person believes in God, and God's sovereignty requires complete devotion, whereas government only requires allegiance and civil duties. The Constitution itself treats religion differently, giving America religious liberty and the freedom to exercise. Visit frc.org/university to hear more about this issue.
I'm Tony Perkins, and this is Washington Watch. The website, TonyPerkins.com. If you're on Twitter, it is at T Perkins. All right. The 13th largest city in California, which, by the way, was the second largest city to file bankruptcy back in 2008. They have since emerged from bankruptcy, I think, in 2015. Well, they're pursuing yet another plank of the liberal utopia, universal basic income. What does that mean? Well, the mayor of Stockton, California, Michael Tubbs, wants to give a select group of poor residents $500 a month, no questions asked, in an experimental program to test the effects of giving people a universal basic income. Now, how does this, match up with President Trump's tax reform that fueled the free market, which has allowed people who work to get wage increases, bonuses, allows companies to expand to hire more people? Which is better? Well, joining us now with an answer is Ken Blackwell, Senior Fellow for Human Rights and Constitutional Governance at the Family Research Council, former Secretary of State and Treasurer in the state of Ohio. Ken, welcome back to Washington Watch.
Tony, good to be with you, sir.
Well, I know you were with the president, actually, I think the First Lady yesterday. The president, First Lady were in Cincinnati yesterday touting the tax reform plan. Is that correct?
Absolutely.
And I mean, already we're seeing the effects of this. We're seeing, we're seeing increases in take-home pay. We're seeing bonuses. We're seeing raises. We're seeing expansion. Isn't that the way the free market is supposed to work?
Absolutely, Tony. And I've had the benefit of traveling across the globe, and I've looked at all kinds of systems and experiments and socialist economies. And one of the things that you find is that all too often those countries that come up with schemes that create income floors, guaranteed income floors, all too often those floors become ceilings for far too many people. And that's the problem with the experiment that's going on in this misdirected city that you mentioned. Look, there's a clash between those of us who want to create an American Opportunity Society. We recognize that to get there, we have to, as the president has done, fuel economic growth and job creation. And then we have to be a society that encourages individuals to prepare themselves for work opportunities and work. That's up against this notion of expanding the welfare state, the administrative state, with its income distribution system that is more interested in creating dependents and wards of the state than self-sufficient individuals and families.
Well, I mean, we've seen the government's war on poverty. And, I mean, I think we're $20 trillion is what it's cost us, and poverty is still with us.
It did not eradicate poverty. Absolutely. And that's why you and I and groups like the Club for Growth, the Heritage Foundation, we have been advocates of models that grow our free market system and put an emphasis on those things that are unique in the American experience that has, in fact, put a harness on the reach and power of government and optimize individual opportunity and individual freedoms. And as you and I have crisscrossed this country and told people that two of the things that are unique to totalitarian welfare states and other systems that are government-focused is that they do two things. They have two things in common. They try to run God and faith out of the public square because they know that if, in fact, there is no God, government becomes God. You know, and they weaken, if not destroy, families to enhance dependency not on families and individual initiative, but on government handouts. And that's the battle that we're engaged in. This is a president that understands the nature of capital. He's redirected capital that's been parked offshore back into our economies. We're building our capital plant with an infrastructure strategy that he's going to roll out next week, as well as we've given folks and businesses an incentive to invest in workers right here in our country.
You're listening to Washington Watch. I'm your host, Tony Perkins. My guest in this segment, Ken Blackwell, senior fellow here at the Family Research Council, but also a member of every board in America of conservative organizations, practically. But there's a reason. He also served as mayor of Cincinnati, one of the country's largest cities. And in full disclosure, I was actually born outside of Cincinnati, so I'm familiar with the area. Grew up there first 14 years of my life. It's a nice city. It's a very nice city. A lot to do there, a lot of culture there in that city. And, Ken, you came from, if I can say, one of the minority communities. You're an African-American leader. You elected to the city council, became mayor, went on to run statewide, even running for governor of the state of Ohio. And I want to I mention that because this is not just two white guys talking about this. These are both individuals who actually grew up in the lower economic stratus of our country. But one of the things that they lay out in this study, the Economic Security Project, which is contributing $1 million to this initiative, a guy by the name of Doran Warren, said that they will be monitoring how basic income affects things like self-esteem and identity. Now, you and I both know that the evidence is overwhelming that it's, yes, money is important. It absolutely buys essentials, milk, bread, shelter, clothing, all that stuff is essential. But self-esteem comes from accomplishing things, of being rewarded for doing something that is contributing to the benefit of others, not just getting something.
Oh, absolutely. And that's why, you know, for all of my life, I've been an advocate of the dignity of work. People want to be a full participant in their own upliftment. If you make them overly dependent upon government handouts, you lock them into a status and you sort of throw cold water on incentive to do those things necessary to go to the next.
Well, that's the ceiling you talked about.
That's right, absolutely. Absolutely, Tony. And look, when my dad came back from World War II, he came back to Cincinnati, and there was still vestiges of segregation. There was a housing shortage, and we lived in a public housing community about four blocks away from City Hall. And he, in fact, could have gotten locked into a system, but he understood that even folks who did go into a system of assistance, there was a temporariness to it. It was a temporary status.
Right.
And what has happened with our system is that it has become a self-contained lockdown system for far too many people, making them not full participants of their own upliftment, but in fact dependents and wards of the state, and that's the route that takes you to higher crime rates, that takes you to more people who are alienated and out of a sense of and locked into a sense of loneliness, which can only be destructive and disruptive. So the other thing that these folks who are experimenting with these socialist systems don't realize is that America and Americans are among the most charitable people in the world.
Yes,
and,
without question.
And so those when folks have more money to give and more money to invest in their own upliftment, they also, as I just mentioned, have more money to give, and Americans give. And they direct it not to systems that make people more dependent, but they give them to programs and institutions that are geared to making people more independent and more a participant in their own upliftment.
A hand up rather than a handout.
Absolutely, sir.
Ken Blackwell, as always, great to have you on the program. Thanks so much, my friend.
Thank you, Tony.
All right, Ken Blackwell, senior fellow here at the Family Research Council, a great American who has a fascinating life story. He has been everywhere, knows everybody, and it's just because he has dedicated himself to hard work, and he's seized opportunities. And one of the things, and I want to seize upon this as I wrap up our time together, notice what he said when his dad came back from World War II. He had a mom and a dad. And yes, they were in for a period of time. They were in public housing, but they didn't stay there. And one of the reasons they didn't was because they had a mom and a dad who cast a vision. And so I want to go back to my conversation with Dr. Beth Green, because, folks, this is so significant. And we at the Family Research Council have done a lot of research on this. In fact, Dr. Pat Fagan, who was with us for a number of years until we kind of spun off his Marriage and Religious Research Institute, which is now on its own. I think it's housed over at Catholic University. But this is what we dug into to look at the implications of marriage and why it is important. And I'm going to go back to this because it is quite significant. I guess it was last week we had Glenn Stanton on, maybe it was the week before. We were talking about the Harvard research about Christianity is not shrinking, but it's actually growing stronger. Now, that's contrary to what the media has to say, but go figure. One of the aspects of this Harvard research pointed to, the article, he pointed to Pew reports, because everybody's saying, well, millennials are walking away from the church. They're not keeping the faith. Well, Pew Research, that young adults who left their faith, only 11% said they had a strong faith in childhood, while 89% said they came from a home that had a very weak faith in belief and practice. So the point is, the kids that, you know, say they're walking away from the faith, they never were there to begin with. Now, it also pointed out, the scholars report, that young adults begin to attend church less often in their independent years. Okay, that's when they leave home and they're no longer forced to go. Well, they kind of try other things. And this has always been the case. It's a part of the nature of emerging adulthood. But as Glenn Stanton points out, just as sure as these young people do other things on Sunday mornings, the leading sociologists of religion find they return to church when? When they get married, when they have children, and they start to live a real adult life. When it is just a radical shift of viewpoint when you have children. And the earlier you have those children in a married relationship, it has a profound impact the way you live your life. And that's why marriage is so important, because you don't have the same benefits outside of marriage. Cohabitation does not elicit the same element of responsibility. The same with having children outside of marriage. It does not elicit the same parental concern. I'm not saying that single parents do not care for their kids. I'm not saying that. I'm talking about from a social standpoint, social policy standpoint. Married couples, all of a sudden, they begin and they have children. All of a sudden, they're concerned about what's on television. They're concerned about the culture. They're concerned about the language that is spoken. Didn't bother them before, but all of a sudden, they're sensitive to those things. And marriage presents so many benefits. And one of the things that Dr. Fagan did when he was with us was 164 reasons to marry. And I don't have time to go through all 164 reasons. But let's look at GPA. A greater fraction of children from intact married families earn mostly A's in school. They have the propensity to go on and get higher education. Behavioral problems. Children from intact families have fewer behavioral problems in school. Poverty. The married family is less likely to be poor than a male or female household. I mean, it just goes on and on. Marriage decreases a child's chance of living in a low-income condition. The children of married mothers experience more upward economic mobility than children of divorced mothers. I mean, the list goes on and on and on and on. Marriage may diminish individual propensity to commit crimes. Married men are less likely to commit crimes. I mean, it goes on and on and on. So what's the point? The point is marriage is good. Two is we need to be teaching our children these things when they're young, the biblical understanding of marriage. But also here, mom and dad, is where you come in. Not only should you teach them, but you should be an example to them. That's so important, that you live out biblical marriage, faithful, loving, kind, compassionate, protecting, nurturing. It's up to us. That's how we can make a difference. All right, folks, out of time for today. Thanks so much for joining us. Check out the website, TonyPerkins.com. Until next time, I leave you with the encouraging words of the Apostle Paul, found in Ephesians 6, where he says, when you've done everything you can do, when you've prayed, when you've prepared, and when you have taken your stand, by all means, keep standing.
Washington Watch with Tony Perkins is powered by the Family Research Council and is entirely listener-supported. For more information on anything you've heard today, or to find out how you can partner with us in our ongoing efforts to promote faith, family, and freedom, visit TonyPerkins.com. Also, to leave a comment about Washington Watch, call our watch line at 1-866-372-7234. Again, that's 1-866-372-7234. 372-7234.